Augie and Bob Buttman are being interviewed by Renee Garlick for Concord's Oral History Program. The interview is taking place at their home at 55 Holdenwood Road on November 20th, 1992. Both Augie and Bob are 72 years old. They are original residents of Conantum, which last year commemorated 40 years since its beginning. How did you become interested in moving to Conantum?
How do we hear about it?
Yes.
Up on it? Well, I was working in Philadelphia and had a job offer to come to the Boston area to work at Lincoln Lab, MIT Lincoln Lab. And I guess we just barely landed in town when we got two letters from friends in Concord, from Lucy Richardson.
Who was my minister's wife in Medford before we were married.
Her husband married us. And also from Ann Brigham, who was a classmate of Augie's, saying it was this funny new place. You should come look at it if you want a house, which we did. So we came out here and looked around. One thing led to another. It was, I think I came out here alone the first time. You were probably taking care of the kids, but it was a pretty mixed up place. Roads were mud, there were building materials all over the place, half finished foundations. It looked in disarray. And in fact, I think it was.
This was the dream of Rupert McLaurin?
It was Rupert's dream. We don't know exactly when he dreamed it. I've often wondered when he woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning and said, I have this great idea. But he gets pretty much full credit for starting the ball rolling.
He was an economics professor at MIT?
He was, mm-hmm. Yes.
And what was his vision here? What was he trying to do?
Well, I think he felt that the pay that the assistant professors, especially the lower level professors at MIT, were getting was not adequate for to pay for a normal house, typical house, I should say. I think it was his view that by building a number of houses together, by getting a good buy on the land, by pooling resources, he could create a community that was not only affordable, but unique, in the sense that it would bring a group of people together who were compatible, and who were, and in fact became more compatible because of the experience of moving in, and also would be a neighborhood that had common land and sort of the comforts of life that you didn't find in an ordinary neighborhood.
Didn't he also think that people should be able to have an acre of land? I mean, not should, but he'd like to have people be able to have space, as I remember.
I think that was important, yeah.
Do you remember what the cost of homes then were?
Sure. Ours,
I don't.
I have a list, but we don't need that. I can tell you ours, the cost of the house was $11,660. We had an expensive lot. It was $4,300. And the mortgage was a 20-year, 4% mortgage. Our payments, monthly payments were about $90 a month. That covered taxes, payment of the principal, and interest. Makes you laugh.
Did you have a large down payment to reserve your lot?
Augie should maybe tell this story. I had to go back after I'd seen this place. It said that's never mind the mud and confusion. It looks great.
It was
on a weekend. I had to go back to Philadelphia, and so Augie said, "Well, I'll put $10." We found out it took $10, so Augie put $10 down.
I thought you were going to say about we didn't have a big amount of money to put down because
we
had just, my aunt had given us land in Nantucket. My family's been there for a long time, and we had just built a house a summer house, because we needed to get out of our parents' house. And so we didn't have a big, I thought that's what you meant, we didn't have a big amount to put down, but
$10 we had.
Yeah, $10 we had. And my father gave us some money.
He did.
Yeah.
Loaned us,
yeah.
$10 kept us going until January when we signed the formal agreement.
We went crazy because my father was a lawyer, and we were only one other couple that had a lawyer take care of things, and he said, "I won't do a thing until it comes through correctly." And
he wanted a real deed. He didn't want an agreement.
He didn't want an agreement. So we sat with that $10 for almost 6 months.
Well, it was maybe three.
Maybe 3 or 4. So we were really worried.
But what he said was,
the best thing for me to say. He said, "Well, you know, I've been around looking with you at places to. I know you want to have a house." And he said, "I think this will be a fine project, but I do think it'll go bankrupt."
And was he right?
He certainly was right.
Could you share that time? What happened?
What did
about
you do?
The bankruptcy?
About the bankruptcy.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
when we first came out here in September, there was a financial pinch. We didn't know it at the time. The land was bought by McLaurin and Horace Bright. I don't know anything about Bright, but he put in some money, $13,000, I believe. And in September, he said, "I want my money back." And so McLaurin gave him his money back, and that made a cash-tight situation worse. So McLaurin went to some of the members and said, "Help me out." Brown, Adler, Levinson.
Somebody else.
One other.
Oh, definitely.
I can't remember one other, but anyhow, they put in $16,000, which was a fair amount of money, and McLaurin matched it with a loan of his own, but it wasn't enough, and so by late April of 1952, Canadian Realty Trust, as such, became bankrupt. McLaurin then bought it out of bankruptcy. I believe he paid $50,000 for the assets. At that time, Canadian still owned them, I think, something like $74,000 for the land. And I don't think I think he ended up with a loss. It was probably $100,000 or more that he had put in of his own money.
This took a personal toll on him.
Yes. Mm.
In what way?
Well, I think it probably broke up his marriage. I'm not sure. It was probably a contributor. He went on to build a few more houses in behind us here and in Wayland, and he became despondent after that, committed suicide. It was maybe 3 or 4 years later. I don't know how much of it relates to what he went through here and how it was influenced by other factors, but it was a sad ending for someone who'd done so much for him.
Do you think he had money of his own, or was that going on a professor's salary?
It is our belief that it was his wife's money, which didn't help the situation any.
That's what I
wanted.
What was the morale like when you were going through this bankruptcy time here?
I think it was good.
It was exciting. You didn't know what was going to happen.
No, but as far as we're concerned, I think I just had faith it was going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
I was young enough and innocent enough so that I didn't think we could get into deep trouble, though clearly we could have if McLaurin hadn't done his thing.
we had a meeting about the bankruptcy, and we had a very good man then, very good friend of ours, who was chairman, and he did a wonderful job at that meeting. That was out of the first parish, and it lasted till one or two in the morning to decide, what to do.
I don't remember what was said exactly.
I don't either.
Every aspect of it was, I'm sure, talked about.
Yeah. This was a very unique community in many ways. The size of it, even.
100 houses was what was planned. And I didn't blame the Concord public then, since we were the first development that came to Concord, and it caused a big stir, and it was very, I would imagine, for myself, who loves the out of doors, I imagine it was very uncomfortable for them to think of all this woods being taken out. People used to hunt here and do all kinds of things. But it was to be the first development in Concord with 100 houses. And yet I think you told us that Sam Kent really, I don't know how did he do it in editorials for his paper, that he thought it might be an asset, but you're over anxious about it.
Yes, he was a member of the planning board as well, so that helped.
And of course the houses were very different. We're the only ones that have big windows then, and people used to come by after we were in them and to look at the windows, because obviously we didn't have curtains right away. That was one thing that was kind of interesting to people. And,
very contemporary.
Very
style.
Contemporary. And mm-hmm. Also, I don't know that you know this, but our deeds said no discrimination of any kind. People come in.
Race, color, creed, national origin.
So they didn't know what.
Not to be discriminated against.
Right. They didn't know what kind of a group was coming in.
They were fearful, suspicious of you as a group?
Well, because we didn't know that at the time. I didn't know anybody. I knew Lucy Richardson and Ann Brigham, but I just heard, I don't think I knew that people felt that much. We thought we were wonderful.
I would imagine being the first development, they would think of it as an invasion of sorts, and a huge group for them, group of people suddenly showing up in town about whom they knew nothing. And so
you didn't say about the new foundations. We'll put hay on it for friend feeding. The deer ate the hay off.
That's what it was said.
I thought that was pretty funny.
We're out in the country.
But this was a Republican, conservative community. The new neighborhood people tended to be more liberal. Maybe some Democrats?
Yes.
There were definitely Democrats. So we had some Jewish families, and of course this town must have been very WASPy at that time. That probably worried people a little.
About how many Jewish families were there?
In the beginning?
Yeah. About how many Jewish families out of the 100?
Half a dozen.
Yes.
Okay. So the numbers seemed to loom larger in people's minds than the actual families.
Yeah.
How did the town treat, once you were established, how did they treat you as far as services and water hookup and all of that?
Fine. I don't know. I guess the one thing I have in my mind was going into Concord Lumber, and he said, I was asked, do you want to charge it? And I said, yes, and that's fine. And so, I think that was the atmosphere. I know myself, we were well accepted right away. Though we were so busy with our families and our own troubles here that I think our early interaction with the town was minimal, but there was certainly no trouble.
One of the things that I looked up for talking with you in 1953, one person from Conanham was put on a board, the Board of Records and Archives, I think. And I had thought, now that shows that they were accepting us. And by 1957, the number had increased to 7. And in 58, there were 9. And then it kind of kept around that mark. And the highest was 13 in 1980.
You mean 1960?
No, I mean 1980.
Oh, I see.
13. Mm. I just happened to read those and back to 9 in 1990. So I felt very pleased that all those people were serving, and they're all excellent people. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really knew their stuff, and so I felt that showed that the community began to accept us a lot, and they were pleased to have us in the schools. They were worried in the beginning, but they found that, that was a really, kids were...
I think it's fair to say it's a fairly bright neighborhood in the sense of professional mental abilities of the people who've lived here. It was virtually 100% Harvard and MIT when we moved in. I don't mean to brag about it, it's just that's the way it was.
That's because McLaurin was at MIT
that's where the publicity was.
Yeah, that's right.
In those two schools.
Yeah.
You had your own neighborhood association.
We still do, yeah, we did. We have board of directors is what we have.
Actually, the Calmy Awards Corporation is the governing body, and it has a board of 7 directors, president and treasurer, and we have a yearly budget to maintain the common land, do what other little things we may want to do, like have parties now and then. It was initially very active when we were involved with the construction, but since then it's tapered off. But over the years, the community with sort of the governance of the board has, we built tennis courts, we bought up water pumper for fire protection in the early days. We converted the cornfield into what we call a ball field. We have community gardens. There was a lot of community activity, has been, and though maybe not as much now, there's still a more than average, for sure.
And socially also, we have a Christmas sing around the tree that's been right from the beginning.
Open houses.
And open houses afterward Christmas. That the committee worked out to, people would choose people they wanted to have come or whatever way they did it. And we had, on the 4th of July for I don't know how many years, we had a band that was made up of people who played instruments, and they marched down to the ball field, and the kids all had floats. I remember our 3 children doing the signing of the Declaration of Independence, I think. They had,
powdered
wigs and everything. And that was really fun. Then we went down to the ball field and had all kind of eating.
Sideshows
and painting faces and stuff. That, as we grew older and the kids got older, and maybe because we had a little more money, a lot of us weren't around so much in the summer, so that the 4th of July kind of dropped out. But the Conanham other parts, especially the Christmas stuff, that's always been so. Then we've had, there's been a woman's sewing group here that started, still is going.
Garden club.
Of course, we did all it. We skated a lot. That's not the same subject I'm on, I guess. We did a lot of,
Family activity. We skated on the river. We skated in the snow and the rain. And
cross country all around.
Cross country, went on trips together, hiking trips, backpacking trips.
We also had that picnic on the gravel pit, which we had one time. Dick Marshall, who came from Maine, did a whole huge thing of lobsters, a big, over, you know, over smoking, big pumpkin fire. So we've always kept, we always had been doing things together, and as people came in, as time went on, we tried to get them to get to know us too, and most of them did know us.
So many of the original residents have remained.
Around 30, isn't it now?
I think it's about 30.
30 houses.
They're beginning to drop off, move away.
But
going
after
to retirement
40
home,
years,
a lot of people just wouldn't want to move. You know, mm-hmm. I was talking to somebody the other day saying, I'm going to stay right here.
Along those lines, it's fascinating that I think all but about 15 houses have had substantial modifications, which to me means, mm-hmm. though the house was inadequate, people didn't want to move away, so mm-hmm. they modified what they had.
Yes, and I think that stability characterizes this neighborhood. But I was told at the very beginning you had your own, you were not hooked up with water to the town.
That's true.
We had we had 7 wells that were drilled down by the river, 250,000 gallon storage tank up on the hill, highest plot of land. The original construction included 8-inch water mains. We had to set up as a public utility because we were dishing out something that had health considerations and we had to be overseen, the state said. So we were did set up a public utility to run the waterworks, but it was so complicated, there was so much paperwork that we didn't need. So we set ourselves up a little later on in 1953 as a water district. So we became an independent water district. And that continued until about, I think it was around 1980 when we finally disbanded the water district and became ordinary customers. We've been buying water from the town. We shut down the wells pretty early also. Shut down the wells from the town, extended the water system out here, and from 1956 on we bought water wholesale from the town. And then in about 75 it was, we began to put meters in, and gradually through with a lot of negotiation worked away into being ordinary customers.
It was a water board district. People had to be careful about it and go over and check it. And we added fluoride to the before it came to Concord. So that was, and I went to the dentist the other day and he said, you know, I've noticed that Cananum children, when I first saw them, had many fewer cavities than others, and then of course Tom put it in Appling, and then we hooked up. But that was one of those things when our annual meeting, we had a terrible time, where 2 or 3 people were just really against the fluoride. They thought it was terrible. And in fact, some of them are still using their own bottled water, I think.
Well, that's because, I don't know if that's all because of fluoride or just because they worry about any outside water.
But I thought that we were very, he said, the dentist said, well, you know, that's pretty good. You got that going for that soon.
Would you like to move on to talk about your town involvement? Anything else you want to say about Cananum?
I'll do it first. You got in there before I did.
Actually, you had the temerity in 1964 to run for selectmen.
I did indeed. I went on the Recreation Commission. It was 1959. I don't have any remembrance of how or who appointed me or anything. And I mean, in my whole life, kids and the out of doors and conservation have been my main things. So that was a good place for me to be, and I really enjoyed that a lot. We worked a lot on, well, for instance, on the rifle range. One of the reasons that we, I'll start over again. We did do things on the rifle range. We tried to get places, we started to fix it up and get little places where people could have fireplaces. That never worked. But when the town was, I don't know when this was, when the dump went in over here, but that was during recreation time when I was on the commission. And they came to us, the commission, I don't know if I was chairman then, that doesn't matter. The committee that had looked at the dump had decided it would either be at the rifle range or at the Group 2. And we talked about it and they said, no way. We were unanimous that it wasn't going to be there, which I think was a very smart decision because it has that swamp and it's a big dump in that area. It's all houses now would not have been very good. So that was kind of interesting. And I got, when I was chairman, kind of pushed along, and I was very interested in this land of Ben Smith's. I think he was going to sell it. This is my remembrance. And I talked to him, and he said that he was possible to do. So I went to the town manager, who was then Ted Nelson, who was the nicest guy, and I'd already done some things with him, and I said, I really want to buy this land for the town for recreation. He said, okay, you do this, you do this, and you do this, and then come back to me. So I already told him, and I had talked to Ben Smith, and he... So I got the things, and I'd come back and tell him, he'd say, okay, now, do this, do this, do this. And we finally got it through town meeting, and the Riverdale Association said that they would help do the developing of it, whether they wanted to have a skating pond or whatever. But that was really exciting to me, and it was so much fun to work with a town manager to feel I was really doing something. And then also I didn't tell you that Ben Smith, I think quite a few people knew that, had a terrific collection of Concord arrowheads. I don't know if that was known before. Then when you skated on Warner's Pond, that was not a public access to the pond from, what's the name of that street that goes by Warner's?
Commonwealth.
Yeah. And so I can't remember the details, but I found out that a man named, I think his name is Anderson, was the head of Concord Oil, and he owned it. So I again went to, probably I went to Ted, I don't remember, but he said, I said, would you be interested in giving the land to the town so we could do it? And he said, yes. And I can't find any, I haven't had time to look hard, but so we got that piece of land too, so I felt really good about that. And then the Planning Board, Conservation Commission, and the Recreation Commission worked hard when the Fry development went in. It's where was that? That was near the Throw Hills, I guess you'd call it. And that was where there was a swamp there that people felt, I've forgotten the flower that's there that's very important. So we worked on that and we got some land. I think the town bought it then, I'm not sure, but I don't know. So those are all really interesting things. But we also, when I was on the board, we made that place, the playground place with some asphalt that was to play basketball and that kind of thing. We resurfaced the tennis courts. I remember that, people worrying about that, and we did that, and we fixed up the playground, and it was a very interesting thing. And then in 1964, I said, I'd really like to run for selectman. I don't know why I had that idea. My family was a political family. My father had been mayor, and I have other members in that kind of situations. And so I tried it, and I thought I did very well, and I was the last of the four, two made it, and the two of us didn't. So then when Roger Duncan came to me, he was on the school committee for 6 years, and I had actually run his campaign for him, and he said, "You know, Augie," he said, "I think you'd really like the school committee. I think that'd be much better for you than selectmen. So why don't I'm going off, so why don't you take my place?" So I said, "Okay," and I made it. It was good, and I really, and he was right. I really did enjoy the school committee. It was a right thing for me. I learned a lot of things. You know, it's like graduate school to be on a school committee. You learn a whole lot. And the two things that I was most involved in and felt very strongly about was METCO and collective bargaining. And it just happened the year I went on the committee, the bargaining law passed in Massachusetts in 1965.
That made it mandatory?
It made it mandatory. So the committee said, "Why don't you go to this course on bargaining so you understand about what would happen and learn about how to do it for towns?" And it was a fascinating thing. It was a 2-week, like, it was a college course, really. And there were people from all over the town, all over, maybe it was in Rhode Island. And I came back, and I was just excited. And I told Virginia Biggie, she was the assistant superintendent of schools then, I said, "You know, it's just so wonderful to have gone back and be learning." And she said, "All right," she said, "you need to go get your master's degree in education." I said, "What do you mean? I can't do that now." "Yes, you can," she said. She said, "It's September." She said, "I'll tell you what to do." Just like Ted Nelson. She had taught at Tufts, and she said, "Do this, go there, do this." So I did. And I ended up being at Tufts for 3 years part-time. And I tried to decide if I wanted to be a teacher or a counselor, but I got my degree in guidance and counseling. And that was really great for two reasons. One thing is it was a wonderful thing to be on the school committee and be learning all the educational stuff along with it at Tufts, even though I can't think now how I combined all that together. I really can't. And then the next year, after I got my degree in 68, I kept on the school committee for another 3 years. And I got a job right away. So, not right away, it was the last week in August I got it. So I was a counselor out in Littleton, and I was there for 17 years. So in a way, the school committee was a two-way street for me. I didn't plan it that way, but it was, and I got to know all the teachers, I just really loved it. It was really good. It was hard. At the times it was very hard, and we had, when I was on the committee, we had 3 changes of superintendents, and that's not always easy. But there was a lot going on. And
I just would like to back up, because of the significance of METCO, if you can explain not only the program, but the vote.
I certainly will. I was very involved in that. I was chairman of the regional school committee that happened when the METCO stuff came up. And
about 1966?
This was 66. The town agreed to the schools of being involved in METCO, 1966. And we had a huge hearing. It was supposed to be one of the largest hearings has been in the town of Concord or something like that. 1,000 people is what I think it was. And so I ran that meeting, and it was quite a meeting. Bob was sitting up in the front row, and he'd give me a little way to signal to each other, so we'd say, let him go, because we had very strict rules. We had set up how long a person could talk, and there was one man that had no way would he stop talking, Bob just said. So I'd follow that. And it was very interesting. It was an emotional time. People were angry. People were really concerned. Bob Coles was there, and he talked very well. And other thing that pleased me was that, what's his name? It'll think, come to me in a minute. Man was on the selectmen, it'll come to me in a minute. And he wrote me a letter afterward and said, that was the best run meeting I've ever seen. I've got that letter posted.
Where did you hold the meeting?
At the high school auditorium. And
could you just explain what the METCO program
was? The METCO program was bringing children from the inner city out to help their education, and on the other hand, to help
as full-time students.
As full-time students, and I'm not so good on the position of how the pay. There was tuition, but sometimes I read in one place it said that the school committee cut the tuition down. I don't quite remember about that, but it was to help them come in, and also for a neighborhood like Conanham, Concord, to see that there is diversity in the world and what they need and look at that whole issue, which was very, very good. And people took, so they came in on the bus, the kids had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning.
These are black students.
Black students mm-hmm. coming in, 5 o'clock, they left at 5, came here, and then went home at night. But I wasn't on the METCO committee, I mean, as it were then, but in the schools, every child had a family that they could come to. Now, the Palmers that live right down here, they had just put a notice in our bulletin just this year saying our Conanham boy who started with us in first grade is now married and he's got a job. I'd forgotten what the job was. She said it wasn't. He wants to buy a house about $100,000. If anybody has any ideas, let me know. So it just carried on, and it was a wonderful thing. I've kept on going to all the kind of anniversaries, the 10th, the 25th, etc. And they've just been enough to make you cry. You know, kids going on to really good schools and loving it and loving the town. You know, there were times that were difficult. There was one time that I'm not quite clear when, but Sarah Eula was superintendent, and there was something of a scuffle. And I think it had to do with black and white, and Sarah took a school bus, and he put all the kids that were involved on that, on the bus, and they left school for the whole day. I don't know where they went, I don't know where, if they went headlong. And that kind of brought things together. And it was a very, I still feel very, very, very strongly about it. It was something that I felt really, I was always brought up to be very open-minded and stuff. My family were conservative, but they really believed in that kind of thing. So it was a good place for me to be.
And then as soon as you went off the board, Bob went on the board.
Compared to the Wallaces.
Leaving.
Setting up a dynasty. Well, I've been... Let me back up a little, because in roughly 68, I felt I was getting a little bored with what I was doing at Lincoln Lab. And I managed to get a sabbatical year and went back to MIT and took courses in psychology and government and did some independent studying and some educational systems, a little computer work, with the idea that I would come back better prepared to do some kind of a project which involved technology and education. And in fact, we did set up such a project. And we worked on it for about 7 years, so no particular great end, but never mind. At the time, the computers weren't up to the job at that time, is really what it amounted to. But that got me looking more at the education business, and then I became an apprentice, an argument on the committee, so
Very helpful he was.
So I ran, and in a field of six, came in second, which is all the openings there were, of course. I think Anna Thompson was third, if I remember correctly.
What I remember about that is that I was worrying so that he wouldn't make it, that I was on the phone saying to people, have you voted, have you voted? Right up to the end, and what...
I was a slim, slim second.
It was about 15 people made a difference, 15 votes.
Well,
I think it was around there. Excuse me for interrupting.
I think of that time, the two terms on the school committee, as being a lot of turmoil. There were a lot of personnel changes. Minuteman Vocational was coming online. 766 was just instituted. Services, mandated services to handicapped students. What? Mental handicaps mostly, but physical handicaps in some cases. We were doing our own collective bargaining still. We didn't have any professionals. We had six different unions to deal with within the school system. And there were a lot of experimental things going on. For example, open classrooms. Big rage. Experimental education of all sorts. Many independent projects being funded in the systems of educational collaborative, for example. I don't think that left any great impact on the system, but they were fun at the time, and I think stimulative, at least stimulated both students and teachers to think and become enthusiastic about their teaching job, which is a plus.
Can I just say, in my counseling point of view, is that they really aren't mentally, they're special needs students in various ways. I think that's, I like
okay.
that better.
Okay. Scratch that. Life education was a big issue. We didn't call it sex. And there was one election where that was a big issue. School was going beyond its duties.
Did it stay, or was it eliminated?
Oh, it stayed, and it faded from view. People got used to it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that bad. And probably it's such a low level of education compared to what's around now. People would smile. I know one of the chief opponents came up to me a couple of years ago and said, well, my youngest kid, it must have been a little more than 2 years ago, my youngest kid is enrolled and it's just fine. No problem. But...
Was the Minuteman Vote Tech an issue?
It was somewhat of an issue, but I think it wasn't a huge issue. I think some of us were just questioning whether it would be all that useful to Concord, whether enough people would go to make it worthwhile. I guess it's been okay. I think one of the things that troubled me a little bit about it was that I was afraid that the sort of homely vocational stuff that we had in town would atrophy, and I think it did. But I'm not sure that that was because of Minuteman or just because carpentry is not something that people do anymore anyway. Just the manual skills that we had at that time simply became, I think, less popular because that's the way the world was going, and it had nothing to do with Minuteman.
You were quite forward-looking in projecting enrollment figures that other members of the school committee thought the population trend was going another way.
Yeah, I was obsessed with population. It was one thing that I spent a lot of time on, and that was it. And I've got...
They didn't believe it at all.
But I didn't have any credentials, so I didn't have any, I was not believable. But they worked out just about right.
I thought it would go down.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm. But the birth rate, while I was on the committee, that's not quite true. The highest birth rate in town was, I guess, in the 50s. And it was about, there were about 250 children born in the town and each year for several years in the 50s. By the time we'd gotten to 1976, it was down to about 100 per year. I may have my numbers not quite right for the year, but this wave was going through and you could see it. The high school was bursting, of course, and I'm saying it's going to 1,500 and then below in the 80s, and we had big arguments about that. We added on where I thought we were doing too much with respect to the addition. We built a with classrooms, we built a gym, a new basketball style gym, and a classroom wing. I thought we should have had a cage and no classroom wing and a swimming pool. But it didn't work out that way. So now we're in high school, what are we, 800 or so now, down from a peak.
I was on the school sites committee for a long time. It was kind of a standing thing. Mm-hmm. And I just happened to remember as you were talking that in 1975, the school sites committee was dissolved because population growth leveled off, so they were listening too.
Well, it is. Population is going up again, to be sure. And what do we find? Look at it. It was 173 children born in the town.
91.
Still, that's down 40% from thereabouts from what it was at its peak. I don't know if we need more space. We hear about overcrowding now, and I guess there are some areas that are overcrowded, though I think probably our standards are higher than they used to be.
Elementary.
And it cannot be that the high school is overcrowded. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
One of the things, have you finished with the school committee stuff from
California? Yeah, I think so.
There were two things.
I guess I came away from the school committee experience feeling pretty hard for a group that works on Tuesdays to influence an organization of 200 or 300 people who work all week. And it was, and I think the leverage that the school committee really has is in choosing the superintendent and the principals and whatever directors there may be. And that's where you really have your chance to do something that will have an impact by finding somebody who believes whatever you believe that you think is correct.
Which superintendents did both of you work with?
Bob Ireland when I went on, and Sayre came in, and then Sloan for me.
Ralph Sloan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ralph Sloan was there for most of the time mm-hmm. that I was there.
What I wanted to say that I didn't say about the collective bargaining was one of the things that impressed me the most was, and what I really worked hard at when I was on the committee, was that you have to be acting in good faith with everybody. And that everybody is acting in good faith. There's a fine opportunity for communication on both sides so you can understand the roles and problems on each side. And I did a lot for that when we first started the collective bargaining. I tried very hard to set up it so it wasn't teachers versus committee, and it It really did work pretty well, and we heard other towns had difficulties, so I felt that maybe we had done a pretty good job. The other thing that I didn't bring up about schools is in my tenure, we just did a lot of schools. We had Sanborn, Ripley Wing, Peabody, 69 Bob's. But they were just, I mean,
new construction.
New construction, so it was, they were feeling, yeah, awful lot of it. So that's all I wanted to say.
Did you feel that you were fighting fires instead of thinking great thoughts?
Oh, yeah, always.
Yeah.
Yes. Every now and then we'd say, we've got to think bigger thoughts, and we went off. I remember one weekend went off and spent a whole day thinking bigger thoughts, and then we came back and started fighting fires again.
Well, I must congratulate you both on your recent celebration of your 50th anniversary. That also is a milestone.
It is a milestone. It's very fun.
Thank you.